WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's the fourth edition of Coastline Beneath the Surface. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. A dozen or so people, diverse in age, ethnicity, and political leanings, have agreed to be part of a year-long experiment in civil discourse. Each month, we bring you a conversation with about half the group. Our aim, to observe whether the tone and quality of the conversation changes as they get to know one another over the course of the year. And to be fully transparent, this is an attempt to go beyond civil discourse to something deeper, more meaningful, and arguably more difficult. As Arthur Brooks notes in his book, Love Your Enemies, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt, going for civility in our political discourse, or tolerance for differing points of view, is a pitifully low standard. Don't believe it, he asks? Then tell people, my spouse and I are civil to each other, and they'll tell you to get counseling. Or say, my coworkers tolerate me, and they'll ask how your job search is going. On this edition of Beneath the Surface, we'll address feedback from listeners, and we'll also tackle some internal feedback, issues that participants have raised about interactions with other members of the group. Remember, this is hard. It's why the country is as divided as it is, because what we typically do when it gets hard is leave the room. It's easier to leave the room than it is to stand with the other person, feel all the things, especially contempt, whether it's coming at us or coming from us. Not only is contempt impractical, good luck filling up all your rooms with people who agree with you, it's also, according to social psychologist John Gottman, unhealthy. Contempt causes a comprehensive degradation of the immune system, and it impairs cognitive processes. So it's bad for your relationships, it's bad for your physical health, and that's true of both contempt giver and contempt receiver. So let's go now to some moments that have caused division within our group. In February, Daryl and Kalisa had an exchange that sparked some emails from listeners, but also left at least one of them feeling uncertain about whether to continue with this project. Our topic was education, and Daryl was explaining his experience growing up in a small town in the Midwest. So going back to school, this Charlie person that you mentioned.
Charlie Connors, yeah.
Was that the only person of color in your school?
That was the only person that we knew, and it...
So it was a very white... atmosphere. It was a very white school.
Like light-skinned. If there were blacks, there were light-skinned and minorities, Orientals and whatnot.
Kalisa responds with her experience growing up in a mostly white Midwestern community as a child of color and how her teacher, who was later fired, accused her of not doing her own work.
My experience was very lonely. I was isolated. My teacher used to say she didn't think that I was really writing my papers. And I've experienced that through high school and college.
Don't want to skip over that.
Sure.
You had a teacher.
Oh, yeah.
Who thought you weren't really writing your own paper.
Oh, yeah.
Because?
There was a very specific incident where my mom had to come up to the school because it had gotten out of hand where she had failed me. And my mom said, so first... all the answers are right, so you cannot fail her. But also on this other piece of writing, it's beautiful. It's immaculate. It sounds like something that a high schooler writes. She has a gift for writing. And so it was this big issue at the school. The principal got involved, and of course the principal was shocked and appalled, and I think that teacher got fired.
So was your family's perception that this teacher accused you of not doing the work? Because you were a child of color?
Oh, for sure. Of course. There's no other reason to fail a child that got 100% on something and you fail them.
Later in the conversation, Daryl comes back with his view of how discrimination is different in the North and the South.
In the South, we discriminate against the race, but in the North, they discriminate against the individual. And what Kalisa was talking about was discrimination against her as an individual. I don't know as necessarily I would attribute it to race, but she's definitely stood out and was different. So you can stand out and be different sometimes because of your color of your skin, or in your instance is your performance was so above what was expected that they said there must be some reason for that. I experienced a similar situation in high school. A science report I did with my partner, Don DeMott. We wrote exactly the same report and submitted it to the teacher. She gave him an A and she gave me a B for exactly the same report. And she discriminated against me because my handwriting was legible. Kalissa, maybe that's what happened to you, maybe because you were outstanding.
Or it could have been race. I mean,
we don't know.
And yeah, we need to not interpret her experience also. Right.
And now we are here with Connette, a health insurance broker, Daryl, retired engineer, Kalissa, a writer and publisher, Jim, a glass artist, and Morgan, who recently earned her master's degree through the creative writing program at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Welcome, BTSers.
Thank you.
So there's a lot to unpack in that exchange. But Kalissa, I want to start with you because you shared with me that you felt a little cut off.
Yeah, I shared with you that I work with a lot of different diversity initiatives here in Wilmington. And one of the rules that they say about dialogue or conversation is you should never tell the other person what they experienced. So I felt like we were kind of breaking the laws of civil discourse there, where I was told what my experience was without there being a moment of listening and really receiving my vulnerability, that I was sharing something that I haven't really shared with a lot of people before, this experience that happened to me that was actually very traumatic attending that school. But because of the time limit that we had, just to directly answer your question, yes, I felt cut off literally and metaphorically, where we ran out of time and I wasn't able to have a discourse with Daryl like I had wanted to or was able to share my point of view about what he had just said and how like his comments had hurt me. So
his comments actually hurt you.
They did. I was very upset. And other folks that, you know, that I had told to tune in to listen to, family members of mine or friends, were upset as well. So
Daryl, do you have a question for? Does it surprise you, first of all, to hear that?
Not really.
It doesn't.
I am not known to be the most sensitive person. I'm an engineer, and I tend to think like an engineer, and I tend to be rather blunt. And I apologize for that. I'm not so sure that. I'm not so sure that after all these years I can change, but I do recognize your viewpoint, and I do recognize that you're very sensitive about it. And I notice that many people are far more sensitive than I am about things. It just tends to roll off my back. I tend to be focused on accomplishing an objective. Give me the mission. Turn me loose, point me in the right direction, turn me loose, and sort of take no prisoners.
Kalissa, can you explain to us specifically what about Daryl's comments hurt you, how it hurt you?
Sure.
Like what it meant to you?
Sure. So I just want to, I guess, expound upon what I was saying before about not really being listened to. I guess I felt like I was sharing a story about how I went to an all-white private school and not really needing anyone to tell me whether or not they thought I was about race, but really needing folks to listen, because that's what I thought we were here for, is to listen to other people's experiences, to receive it, but not to tell me or listeners the reason why that happened to me, because honestly, we don't really know. But also, that experience being in that environment where I was the only was a traumatic experience. And it almost felt like when you said, well, I experienced the same thing, which those two examples to me weren't the same. But when you said that, it almost made me feel like my story wasn't validated, or what happened to me wasn't significant enough to be brought up in a conversation about education and race and diversity. And that's the part that really hurt, that lack of my story being significant enough or relevant enough. Even just the way that you explained it, you said, folks, some folks are sensitive and I believe in getting things done. And I don't think it's about me being sensitive, although I do have a huge heart. That's something about my personality. But I think it's really about wanting to be heard. I just wanted to be heard for that moment. So,
Daryl, does that shed any more light on where Kalisa might be coming from and why it might have been hurtful to her?
Obviously, we all have different narratives that come from. And I can understand, but I really can't be sympathetic because it didn't. I don't have any background from which to sympathize, I guess, and that's unfortunate. And I think the dialogue, hearing you say that and hearing your sensitivity, is quite a bit enlightening for me. There's a book out said Words Matter. And I have been encouraged to read that by my wife, and I have to say that I haven't read it. But
and I'm going to ask you more about that. You're listening to Coastline Beneath the Surface. We're talking with Daryl, Kalisa, Morgan, Jim, and Connette. We're going to be back after a short break, continuing this discussion. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Beneath the Surface. Coastline Beneath the Surface. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's the fourth installment of a year-long experiment in civil discourse. Connette, Daryl, Jim, Kalisa, and Morgan are with us today. While this is a pre-recorded discussion, we welcome listener observations. You can send comments, which we might use for discussion on another edition, to coastline@whqr.org. You can also post on WHQR's Facebook or Instagram. Just before we went to break, Daryl, you were saying to Kalisa that you found her explanation enlightening, but that you couldn't sympathize with her. What did you mean by that?
We all have different, as they, I guess one of the current terminologies is narrative. Mm-hmm. And we all come from different backgrounds and areas. Very difficult for me to experience discrimination and to, other than from my perspective, which I related to you from essentially an intellectual discrimination, but race is something that I've never experienced. And yet, I know that I have many black friends, and most of the discrimination that I have witnessed has been economic discrimination. Poor people are discriminated against, and having grown up from Appalachian roots, I know that there's a lot of discrimination against lower socioeconomic people. And I tend, unfortunately, to put many of the racial issues into that category, my own perspective, knowing that people who are poor tend to get together, and the race thing is not as critical for the poor people, and I can relate that to the experiences that where we've served and things like that. It's more of a social economic level, whereas I've seen equality with blacks and whites who are in the upper echelon of the socioeconomic level. So it's very hard to think along racial terms when your experience has been along socioeconomic terms.
What do you think about that, Kalisa?
That makes a lot of sense, actually. What's interesting is that I think what also added to some of it, so we're relationship building here. And right before we went on air, Daryl and I actually had a really great conversation about his Strawberry Fields project. And so that was the thing that made me kind of cock my head to the side, because I know that he does work with disenfranchised communities and building this community center and helping these folks, many of folks that look like me. And so I guess actually what he just said explains a little more, because I was very confused after having this great conversation. I was like, oh man, me and Daryl bonded. And then when I shared this story, he couldn't understand what I was saying. When he works with this community, or he's building the center for the community that I'm talking about, that feels othered and isolated and alone and doesn't have the same resources as their neighbor. So that makes sense that maybe there's not a connection in Daryl's mind, maybe between race and social economic status, but it's all interwoven. That's what systematic oppression or disenfranchisement is all about, that it's all interwoven. But thank you for sharing that with me, because that helps me understand a little more where you're coming from, because I was confused, I think.
Kalisa, was that conversation before this discussion today, or were you talking about when you first met Daryl?
No, when I first met Daryl, we had this great conversation about his project. And we bonded. It was great. And I was so fascinated about this center that he's building and felt like he got it. And then when we got on air, I was like, oh, man, I don't think he gets what I'm saying. So that's
interesting, because this raises two issues here. I think, first of all, Daryl, could you just explain what Strawberry Fields is, since we're talking about it?
Strawberry Fields is a project that we've undertaken in Chadburn, North Carolina. Chadburn is a very economically depressed area. It's 60% black and 30% white and 10% Hispanic. We have 24 acres of ground that has been given to us, and our mandate is to benefit the families and the youth of the community. And so we've established partnerships with at least five different nonprofits and the city of Chadburn to utilize this land and make it beneficial to the families that are there. So the very first thing that we're doing right now is building community gardens. Food sustainability is very, very important. And we have on that land community gardens being started with Wilmington Green, which is a local nonprofit here in Wilmington. And so we want food banks there. And coincident with that is the community college, Southeastern Community College, wants to develop an agribusiness program. So what we are doing is putting all of these elements together, synergistically coming up with a benefit to everything. And Miss a lady by the name of Hattie Kelly operates an after-school program for at-risk youth. So we're using the community gardens, and she's partnering up the youth with their parents to come and work in the garden. And also the Southeastern Community College wants soccer fields. So we're going to build two soccer fields there on that land. And putting all those elements together benefits the community, and we're all, I mean, it's black, white, it's the community that is focused upon, not the racial mix of the community.
You're listening to Coastline Beneath the Surface. It's the fourth in a series of 12 conversations in which we bring together people whose paths might not normally cross to see how the tone of the conversation changes over the course of the year. With us right now, Daryl, Kalisa, Morgan, Jim, and Connette. And while we're not
doing these shows live, we encourage you to weigh in after the show. We might use your comment as a point of discussion for a future edition. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org or find us on WHQR's Facebook or Instagram. Daryl, you also grew up in a sort of rural, would it have been a socioeconomically depressed area where you grew up?
Yeah. My father was a janitor at Chrysler Corporation, and
your grandfather.
Yeah, my grandfather was tossed out and put in a pig pen when he was 3 years old because he had broken his back, and he was rescued by some neighbors and raised by other people. I mean, you talk about poor socioeconomic levels in Appalachia. That's where it was. So my perspective is quite a bit different than growing up in South Bend, Indiana.
I just want to make sure we understand what you're saying. Your grandfather, when he was a toddler, mm-hmm. was thrown into a pig pen to be eaten by the pigs.
Yeah.
Like they were trying to kill him.
Yeah, they just wanted, look the other way and hopefully something.
Tell us about the people who rescued him.
The family were neighbors that had seen what had happened, and sympathy.
Were they, not that their race matters, but I think it does in this case.
No, it was they were all white.
Okay.
Poor white, and when he turned 14, 15, he went to Irvine, Kentucky, down on the river, and black family took him in and taught him the barbering, taught him how to be a barber. And that's how he survived, and he had a hunchback, but he grew up and was an adult, married, and raised family.
I want to ask the other people at the table, what have you observed about this interaction between Daryl and Kalisa? Morgan, what's going on with you right now?
I'm starting to feel less nervous about being in front of a microphone. This whole premise is really challenging and scary, and the idea of trying to come up with opinions in such a short amount of time. So I'm in awe of you all being able to have this conversation on the air. Primarily, I also keep feeling like there are moments where I'm expecting you all to be angrier at each other. So I think something that would be helpful for all of us is understanding a little more of the language. And I keep hearing things that I'm thinking, okay, that's not language I would use, but I don't know if necessarily the language I've been taught is correct or the most up-to-date either. So I think that might be an interesting thing off-air for all of us to understand how to speak to each other, like Kalisa was saying, with understanding.
Yeah, yeah. And I think part of this, too, there are observable generational differences in the language that people use around some of these issues. Tell me specifically which language struck you as something that might need to be discussed.
Talking, it's so funny, I didn't write it down. It was talking about the principle, I think. There was, maybe it was even going back to the last episode, which we had a refresher on. But I think it just struck me in the moment.
Okay. Jim?
I don't know. After hearing Daryl talk about his upbringing, I kind of understand a little bit more about how some people don't see race as like the huge thing that it is in this country, and can see economic problems being a bigger issue. And I understand that. And I guess I can't relate to that. I see race as being the bigger issue that needs to be addressed. But, race.
You were actually part of a study group recently around a book.
Well, we have a book discussion that we started a little over a year ago where we read books primarily written by African Americans to kind of get our group, which is primarily white, more understanding about the black experience. That's kind of what we do.
And you started with Waking Up White?
Yeah, we started with Waking Up White, which was written by a white woman who kind of realized that in this country, being white is having a race. But being white, you don't think about race. When you think about race, you think about black people. You think maybe you can differentiate between African Americans who were descendants of slaves and people who come here from Africa and people who come here from South America, people who come here from other countries where their skin is brown, and kind of lump them all into a group and call them people of color. But we don't think about being white as having a color. So the idea is to realize that when you are white, there are certain privileges and there's certain benefits that we don't even think about. We just take them for granted. So it started with that. And then from there, we just continued to just read and read all different kinds of books and just trying to expand our knowledge about how big race is in this country.
So is it a fair characterization then to say that despite the fact that you and Daryl are very different in terms of how you perceive issues around race, you kind of understand that there's a compassion there and there's a commitment from Daryl to service in support of these underserved communities, whether you call them socioeconomically depressed or communities of color?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, from just a little bit that Daryl was sharing, I understand that he is committed to doing this Strawberry Fields program, not to heal racial relations, but to heal economic relations. And that's admirable. And if that community was 5% black and 90% white and 2% Hispanic, then it would be just as honorable. But the fact that the demographics of that town is what it is, I think that's admirable. So, and I also got the same feeling when we had an informal discussion with the gentleman who is hosting a family from Africa who are refugees. Now, this is a guy who claims that he's not an activist.
Bruce is another member of the group who is not with us today. He's in a different part of the discussion
right.
group.
So here's an older guy. He's an engineer, too. He's retired, and he saw a need, and he responded to the need. And just the amount of work that it goes into and the economic cost of hosting a family of five, I believe it is, or five or six people, and making sure that that family is housed, fed, and educated is a commitment far beyond anything I'm ever going to be able to do with a book discussion. So there is work to be done with kind of understanding through reading and discussion, and then there's work to be done with like hands and money and shovels, and everything is good. So,
did it surprise you? That Daryl was involved in the Strawberry Fields initiative or that Bruce was helping this family?
No, not at all, because the one thing I've learned is regardless of whether you call yourself liberal or conservative, we all are humans and we see needs that need to be addressed and we address them in the ways we feel that we can. Building a Strawberry Fields community out in the rural part of North Carolina is not something that I can or am able or willing to do. I also cannot imagine hosting a refugee family. So anybody who does that work, I don't care what they call themselves politically or socially or religiously, like they're heroes in my mind, and they need to be applauded and recognized.
Considering both of the people that you're talking about, also, I don't know if this is fair to say of Bruce at this point. He did identify himself at one point as a conservative. Daryl has identified as a Republican. Is it fair to say conservative Republican, Daryl?
I think it's probably better to say I'm irrational. Rational, compassionate, conservative.
So, does that surprise you, Jim, that
Not
you're talking about heroes who are, at the beginning of this whole project, you said that you thought you might have a hard time with people on that end of the spectrum.
I do have problems on that end of this the spectrum on a regular basis.
But until, not with the people.
Not until I find out what they do and what their background is. And you cannot do that until you sit down and talk to them. It's much easier for me to criticize people who claim to be whatever label you want to put on them because I have a preconceived idea of what that is. When I meet the people and I find out their backstory, get a little bit more understanding of why they are the way they are, and that's good. But what's more important is, like, what are they doing? And if they're doing good things, they're doing good things that I can't even do, how can I have bad feelings about them? I can't.
You're listening to Coastline Beneath the Surface. When we come back from this short break, we're going to hear from a listener. If you'd like to weigh in with your own observation, we might discuss your point in a future show. You can reach us at coastline@whqr.org or on WHQR's Facebook or Instagram. And when we come back from this break, we're going to hear from Con Ed. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Beneath the Surface. Listening to Coastline Beneath the Surface. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's the fourth edition in a year-long experiment in civil discourse with about 12 people. They range in age, ethnicity, and political affiliation. We want to find out how the tone of their conversation changes or doesn't when this group, whose paths might not otherwise cross, engage in sometimes difficult conversations. Today, we're spending an hour with about half of them, Morgan, Daryl, Connette, Jim, and Kalisa. These conversations are pre-recorded, and while we don't take live calls or emails, if you want to weigh in, you can do that at coastline@whqr.org or on WHQR's Facebook page or Instagram. We might read your comment as part of the next show. Connette, you have had a chance for the first two segments to kind of observe the unfolding of this dialogue. What observation would you make at this point?
The observation that I see is that in getting to know each other better and understanding, as you had mentioned earlier, why we think the way we think, helps us get along and helps us communicate better. And I'll add, just for another point of view, that I will never know what it's like to be Black or Hispanic or male. I have had instances where, one example, I was told by a primary school principal that he could not hire me, even though I was well qualified, because I wasn't the right color. I have a friend who was told she could not have a certain job because that job was for men. I've had a friend in the last several years who found out that with this large bank, males were given higher commission levels than females. So there's discrimination all the way around. It's not just racial. I'll never know what it's like to grow up privileged. And there are many people who have far less than I have, less education. Everyone has some baggage or something that they may wish they could change. At the same time, we are who we are because of where we've been.
Kalisa, you had a response to something that Jim was saying earlier.
I did. Well, and I want to say just to Connette, but race isn't something that you can change. So I was born with this skin. The difference between socioeconomic status or money or job is the thing about being woman and being a woman of color is those are two things you can't change unless you go through the trans process. So I think it's a little, that conversation is a little different. But to the point that Jim was making, actually it's all interwoven. I think that one of the comments that he was making earlier was, as we strip away the labels and get to know the person, we find out that a lot of folks are doing good work. And while I applaud folks doing good work, something that, again, you have to remember that I work all day long for diversity and inclusion organizations. And so we have this conversation all the time about, quote unquote, good deeds and good work. And I think sometimes what can be problematic, though, is if folks are doing good work without education about the folks that they're doing work for. So that's the part that hurt me the most about the Daryl situation, is if you're going to advocate and start programs for my people, you best get to know them. You best know about their experience. You should listen more if you're going to create programs about those communities. And so when I was hearing Jim call them heroes, I felt myself wincing a little bit. I was like, I think that they're doing a good thing, right? So there's no question that they're doing good work. I also hear him say, I or other folks could never do that. What I hear him saying is they're using their privilege to do good work, which I think is what should happen in the fight for justice. It's folks that have the privilege or have the means, let's say the means to do it, should do it. But I do think that just how you show up every day, Rachel, here to work, and before you interview people, you have to do your proper research. Otherwise, your work is futile. I think the same thing about my white brothers and sisters fighting for the cause. You must research first. You must get to know the people that you're creating programs for. And that's actually a big complaint that a lot of us have, not just Black folks, but a lot of folks, Black, brown, have that complaint in the social justice, social work community. We say folks aren't doing the proper research about the communities that they serve. So that would be my comment.
Morgan, did you have something that you wanted to add?
Yes, I too was struck when Jim was saying that learning about the work that other people are doing makes him feel closer to them and appreciate their full characters more. Because for me, and this is coming from a more political lens than a social work lens, to me it honestly just makes me angrier. I feel disappointed that people who are doing projects that I believe in are still voting for policies that don't support the communities they're helping, or that they are coming from a place of means and have education and still haven't, in my opinion, Daryl used the word rational to describe his political affiliation. And to me, being a conservative isn't rational. And I know that is a hard statement in this room, but it makes me angrier to know that people who have big hearts aren't voting the same way I do.
And you're probably getting to the crux of the polarization in America, because when you stack up a political platform as a lens through which you're viewing a human being, then you've got a stack of generalizations. And when you meet the person eyeball to eyeball, that's when you start to unpack those generalizations. And that's exactly what we're doing here, because as you so eloquently and I think emotionally, passionately expressed, I think a lot of people feel that way on both sides, hence the growth in the culture of contempt, as Arthur Brooks calls it. And he offers some practical, I was going to say practical tips, but they're practices for getting past contempt, because as we heard in the beginning, contempt is anathema to good health. It harms relationships. It shrinks your world. And they've also started to discover that it makes people less rational, less able to think critically, like it impacts your cognitive processes. And so another point that Arthur Brooks makes in the book, How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt, is that it takes practice. He makes a case for Americans being addicted to contempt in the same way somebody might be addicted to a substance. Like, it's a go-to reaction that everybody has to work against. So that said, one of the practices he offers is focusing on the other person's distress instead of on their political position when you're listening. And of course, let go of coming up with a rebuttal while you're listening to that person. That requires a certain amount of open-heartedness to just sit there and allow that person's point of view or distress to come through. The second thing he says is adopt the 5-to-1 rule. That means offering 5 positive comments for every negative one. And Kalisa, you talked about your first social interaction with Daryl before the show and talked about what a, you actually felt very connected to Daryl.
Mm-hmm. I did. I think it's interesting what Morgan just said. I think that that actually leads to more disappointment. Actually, what she just said is what I was saying before,
right,
so eloquently. But yes, the more you get to know someone and the more you bond and the more you know their heart versus like what you see on the surface, you almost have higher expectations for the person when you get to know who they really are, because it's like, come on, man, you have the potential to do great, wonderful work if you just go the extra mile and get to know some of these people, if you just have a conversation with some of them, if you just know what their experience is like, if you'd walk a mile in their shoes, you have the potential to do so much. And I don't think I would be that passionate about someone that I didn't give a hoot about. I'm not going to be that passionate and shake somebody.
So you give a hoot about Daryl.
I do, of course, for sure, because I see the potential that he has. I see the potential that his project, his privilege, his resource has to affect these communities. For sure, I care. I care a lot.
So this is probably a good time to read another nugget from How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. If you wait to feel warm-hearted toward your ideological foes, you may as well have waiting to feel warm-hearted chiseled on your tombstone. Action doesn't follow attitude, except in the rarest of circumstances. Rather, attitude follows action. Don't feel it? Fake it. Soon enough, you'll start to feel warm-hearted towards your ideological foes. And I thought that was such an interesting point, because he's also asking people to take responsibility for their feelings about the feelings that their own thoughts are generating about what we're calling the ideological foe. And in this case, Kalisa, it's probably fair to say that you and Daryl are at opposite ends of the political and ideological spectrum, but you've already found a pretty fertile place for some kind of connection. Daryl, what are you thinking at this point? Are you feeling attacked?
No, not at all. When I was running the MBA program at Fayetteville State University, and Fayetteville State University is a black school, and I used to get calls all the time from the administration wanting to know what the racial mix was. How many black students do you have in the class? And honest to God, I could never tell them. I could tell them how many smart ones we had, how many dumb ones we had, how many lazy ones, how many ambitious ones. So the perspective is quite a bit different from my standpoint. So hearing you talk about my narrative, where I've come from, I can understand and I can be sympathetic to that. And I wish that I could share the homes that I visit, where I sit down and I eat, and the dirt floors that some people have that live in, and houses with no screens on them and stuff, that no windows, and know where I've been. Because where you've come from is really the determination of how you approach problems to solve. The racial problem is a problem that we have here in the country. But my background, I've spent so much of my time overseas in places where I was the only white guy. And it never occurred to me that I was in a minority. So my perspective is quite a bit different, and I applaud the concept of getting to know somebody, being in my shoes. And that's one of the reasons with our Strawberry Fields project, I'm not going to go and try to tell Hattie Kelly how to run her after-school program. She knows, and I don't. Only thing I can do is to facilitate, is try to help her. The reconciliation or the restitution of Chadburn, which is another nonprofit, they know what they're doing. I don't.
Can I just say that I applaud? Thank you. Like, that is what I mean. Exactly. Exactly. Thank you.
All right. I want to get to an email from Carolyn. She wrote to say, thank you so much for presenting this forum. I have friends with vastly different political and religious beliefs, and I'm very proud that we are able to be friends in these turbulent times. She writes, after the election in 2016, I felt like it was the end of the world, and then found out my husband had voted for the incoming president, which devastated me. After a time, I came to the realization this was how people who hated Obama felt when he was elected. Thank you for that email, Carolyn. And we are getting close to the end, but I just want to raise the question, and we might have to carry this forward to another discussion. But we've had people, both inside the group and outside the group, come to us with questions about discussing race. And briefly want to mention Churchill's email. He wrote, as a Southern white male of Jewish Scottish extraction who grew up here, I experienced the Wilmington 10, the attendant riots and tensions. The ratio of black to white in my Brunswick County middle and high schools was nearly equal. Whatever the occasional flare-ups, Churchill says, both black and white races were forced to work, study, and recreate side by side, day to day, for many years. My belief, he writes, is the constant exposure to different others led to less bigotry, a better attitude between the races, and less violent results when trouble did erupt. So we've had people raise questions about, why do you keep bringing up race? Can we move on to something other than race? And again, this has come from multiple people. I do want to point out all of the people who have raised that issue are white. That may be a reflection of my particular sphere of influence, and that white people are more comfortable saying that to me and people of color might not. But I just want to throw it out there and ask you folks how you feel about the fact that race has been a part of every single discussion we've had so far. Is it too much?
Race is going to be a topic for every discussion for the rest of the year. We're going to be talking about race pretty much every time we get together, because at least from my perspective, it is the issue, it is the American issue that affects everything: education, economics, politics, everything.
Connette.
I find that a lot of groups want to segregate. In Apex, there's a neighborhood that's basically all Muslims, and that's where they want to live. And I'll read in our local newspaper that the black business owners meeting or conference is happening. And I think to myself, well, if it said the white business owner meeting, that would be looked at differently. But I think oftentimes people choose to live in a particular neighborhood with their like kind.
For sure. I mean, it's interwoven into everything that we do, even when we don't see it. For me, not just race, but the way in which the systems that have been created were designed to uplift certain folks, certain groups, and diminish others. And I think those systems is how we keep getting back to race.
But this is not the end of the conversation. You can hear the rest of it on our website at whqr.org.
And that's this edition of Coastline Beneath the Surface. Kalisa, Daryl, Morgan, Connette, Jim, thank you all for being with us today. Our producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our web and social media master. Ken Campbell is technical director. Beneath the Surface is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Beneath the Surface. Thank you. Connette, you had pointed out that you had something you wanted to share.
From President Truman, a speech he made, he said, "We believe that every man should be free to live his life as he wishes. He should be limited only by his responsibility to his fellow countrymen. If this freedom is to be more than a dream, each man must be guaranteed equality of opportunity. The only limit to an American's achievement should be his ability, his industry, and his character." And he emphasized, "When I say all Americans, I mean all Americans." And I think that's what we need, is for everyone to think equality, give people opportunity, bring wages up, free market, freedom. That's what's important.
Morgan, you wanted to say something about the question of whether race should be coming up in every single discussion.
Yes, I was shocked to hear that people are complaining about this, because living in Wilmington, it's such a segregated experience, and I can't fathom how they think this isn't an important topic when it affects all of our lives, even if it is invisible. I don't think it feels invisible at all. I actually moved here from San Francisco, and that has a different demographic, of course, than Wilmington. But even if I go to Raleigh-Durham for a weekend, I'm shocked by how much more integrated the places that I find myself are than
where,
when I'm
where
here.
Where do you see the segregation in Wilmington?
Everywhere. Unless you're on a street, you know, the restaurants and coffee shops that I frequent, there aren't many people of color in those. The movie theaters feel a little more, which is interesting because that was y'all's first conversation about movie theater integration. But that feels like a more equal place, potentially. That relates to socioeconomic things as well. The beach doesn't even feel integrated, and that's practically free, but not when you think about transportation to get there and parking and that kind of thing. So I think this is an important conversation, and that even within this room, we're only we're lacking representation, and so it's hard to have even here, but I think it's worth having.
Does anyone else have anything they want to add? Connette?
I find that a lot of groups want to segregate. In Apex, there's a neighborhood that's basically all Muslims, and that's where they want to live. And I'll read in our local newspaper that the Black Business Owners meeting or conference is happening. And I think to myself, well, if it said the White Business Owner meeting, that would be looked at differently. But I think oftentimes people choose to live in a particular neighborhood with their like kind. And other than being respectful to one another and realizing we all have equal opportunity and we all have some kind of baggage, we have to move forward and not make everything so black and white.
Anyone else? I saw a big in-breath there, Jim.
Yeah, I can't believe when I hear white people say things like, people choose to live with their own people. And I understand that people may think that way because that's how it appears right now, and that's how it has appeared for the last 100 years. But I don't think any white person can make that statement, nor should make that statement. I think black folks should say whether or not they feel that way. I think it's a huge assumption to assume that people choose to live where they live. And when I think about if I was a black person and I had the money and I wanted to live in any neighborhood I could live in, if I had enough money, if I chose to live in a neighborhood that was all white, knowing the history of the response of the fellow white residents, what it has been in almost every city in this country, I would not want to move into a white neighborhood. Now, then that's my choice, isn't it? That I'm choosing to live in a black neighborhood, because if I choose not to, I'm going to be possibly subject to all kinds of abuse based on the history of this country. So,
not when you get to know your neighbor, in my opinion. My parents lived next door to a black couple. They were lovely people. There was no one harassing them. And it was basically a white neighborhood.
Where and when was this?
It was in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, probably in the 80s.